Welcome to the Brian Kane Peak Performance Podcast. On each and every episode, Brian talks with coaches, athletes, and performers in all arenas who are putting into practice the principles of peak performance that will help you close the gap from where you are to where you want to be, to help you become a master of the mental game, and to help you start dominating the day.
Hey, how you doing? Brian Kane, your peak performance coach here with the Brian Kane Peak Performance Podcast. And today our guest is Kirk Sarlos. Kirk was an All-American pitcher at Cal State Fullerton. He pitched for the Team USA Collegiate Baseball National Team, was a part of throwing a no-hitter in his Major League Baseball career, and is now one of the most sought-after college baseball coaches and a pitching coach for the TCU Horned Frogs, who routinely have put out one of the best pitching staffs in the nation under his tutelage. Kirk, thank you for taking so much time, man, out of your schedule to sit down and talk with us today just about the mental game and your career. I really appreciate it. And if you could get started with just kind of your exposure to the mental game and where you got started and kind of how you got to where you are today.
Well, thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me. It's an honor to be on one of your podcasts. Really, my mental game kind of tutelage and understanding came from back at Cal State Fullerton in my 4 years there. Ken Revisa, you know, one of the forefathers of the mental game, was a professor at Cal State Fullerton and also worked with the baseball team. So I kind of got a double whammy with Ken. I took his class, and also he worked with the baseball program. So from my freshman year all through my 4 years at Cal State Fullerton, I was able to be around one of the best in Ken Revisa, and really taught me the benefits of what the mental game can do for you, and especially for me. You know, 6 foot right-hander, 180 pounds, came out of high school throwing 83, 85 miles an hour, not the most gifted physically. I really tried to take my mental game to another level because I knew that was going to be a separator for me to allow me to get on the field at Cal State Fullerton as soon as I could. So I knew I had to buy into something because I knew I needed a separator to get me on the field. So that's where it started for me, and from that point forward, I saw results from the first day that he incorporated the things that he was trying to get across from the mental side, and just kind of ran with it from there.
And then, if you would, Kirk, talk a little bit about just kind of the journey in your career. Of you play at Cal State Fullerton. I think your last year was 2001. Mm-hmm. I see you pitching in the College World Series in 2001, and then I rolled into Cal State Fullerton in August of 2001. So I missed you by probably about 3 months. And when I did my grad assistant there, both with Ken and with the Fullerton baseball program, so I remember you were always rolling in there and throwing bullpens and always being fascinated at how you could make a baseball move as much as you did, man. But talk a little bit just about kind of you get out of Fullerton in 2001, going to Omaha, College World Series, and your career from that point here, kind of that 15-year snapshot in a minute or so.
Sure. So I only got a minute for 15 years?
No, you guys as much time as you want, man.
They're okay. So from freshman year to senior year, it was a gradual progression for me in terms of results on the field. And I think really it was me getting better and better with the mental game allowed me to have success and sustain success at the collegiate level because I felt like I streamlined my mental game approach each and every year, tweaked things, changed things to try and make it the best possible by the time I would leave Cal State Fullerton and go play professionally. My goal was to leave after my junior year, never got drafted, didn't get drafted out of high school, didn't get drafted after my junior year at Cal State Fullerton, and I was crushed and came back for my senior year, obviously, and had a great year and went in the third round. So I think that last year was pivotal for me to springboard into pro ball. I got worried about maybe the wrong things my junior year in terms of the draft and focused my senior year on my team, mental game, and trying to compete pitch for pitch and trying to get our team to Omaha because it was my last year at Cal State Fullerton and I didn't know what pro ball had in store for me after that. So once getting to pro ball, I knew, just like in college, my separator was going to be the mental game. My stuff, you know, a little bit harder after the 4 years at Fullerton in terms of my velocity, but I was who I was, and I knew that the only way I was going to get to the big leagues was to keep my head down and refine my mental game and trust it and not pick my head up until I got there. And that's kind of what happened. Got to the big leagues within 12 months after getting drafted, and I don't think I get there. I know I don't get there without, you know, just the mental side of the things I learned from Ken Revisa and seeing myself have success and not really worrying about my surroundings, but worrying about what I can control. So 12 months after leaving there, getting to the big leagues was a big thing for me. And then using it for my 5-year big league career, was pivotal in me getting to the big leagues and staying there.
So, you know, Kirk, you had only that 1 year of taste of minor league baseball and then 5 years in the big leagues. Did you notice that there were guys, I mean, like you said, you came out of high school throwing 83, 85, and we've seen it in college baseball now and even at TCU, which almost eerily reminds me of a Preston Morrison, who was not drafted out of high school, not drafted his junior year, and I think will pitch in the big leagues. Mm-hmm. Reminds me a lot of you. You know, did you see guys that had more ability that maybe did not even come close or having understanding of the mental game that just never made it because they couldn't go pitch to pitch or control what they can control or some of those things you're talking about?
Absolutely. For the most part, I saw it from the high school player, because a lot of times those programs don't have the resources to get a Brian Cain or a Ken Revisa or someone that is going to help them on the mental side. It's mostly they're going to get by with their physical gifts. Well, in pro ball, ultimately that stuff starts, you know, really all the stuff starts evening out in terms of the physical ability. And the thing that I saw was a separator was the mental game. Not only just how to deal with failure, but how to deal with success, you know, because you're going to have success. How do you prolong that success? How do you keep the negatives and the failures at a minimum and prolong your success? And a lot of that has to do with how you treat failure and how you treat success. So there's way more talented guys in single A, double A, triple A than myself. And I think, once again, it was a commitment and to the knowledge that the separator was going to be the mental game. You know, so you can fly right by people just because they're relying and thinking that it's a physical thing, but really it's the 6 inches between your ears that is going to get you from double A to the big leagues or triple A to the big leagues. And I think some people don't really get that.
You know, Kirk, you've talked a lot about how the mental game has made a difference for you. Let's kind of drill down now into some of the specifics about what exactly is the mental game. Well, I guess right now we're talking about Kirk Sarlos, the player. We'll jump into Kirk Sarlos, the coach, here later on in the interview. But let's talk again about you as the player. What was your mental game?
Being able, for me, my mental game was getting myself in a spot internally, mentally, prior to competition. I'll go back to my senior year in college when I was a starter and reliever. I'd relieve on Friday nights and close on Friday nights and then start on Sundays. So my mental game would really start, you know, the Friday was more of a live bullpen to close out games, but my mental game would start as soon as that Saturday afternoon game was over. My mental game triggered in, and it was all about preparation for that 1 o'clock game on Sunday, all the way to rubbing up baseballs the night before my start, and then getting in that kind of hourglass the morning of on Sunday morning, having a routine Saturday night, going to bed at the same time, waking up at the same time, having the same meal in the morning, just to try and control the things that you could actually control prior to the game, and getting in that hourglass and basically knowing that you're giving yourself the best possibility to have success by controlling the things, the few things that you can control leading up to a start. And that was routine. That was breathing. That was breathing exercises. That was visualization and seeing success, seeing that recording in your mind of you having success over and over and over as you go to bed, and then seeing it leading up all the way till game time of just a recorder of you just dominating time in and time again, so that by the time you take that mound at 1 o'clock on a Sunday, for me, I had nothing but positive mental images going through my mind, which allowed me to kind of then have success. You know, as opposed to worrying about the things I couldn't control, I was flushing my mind with stuff I could control, and that was positive things.
When you would get into a red light, which for people that are new to the podcast would be the analogy straight out of Heads Up Baseball with Ken Revisa, where he talks about driving a car. And if you drive a car and you come to a red light, you got to stop. If you're in a green light, you just keep going. But if you're in a yellow light, you're kind of that in between, and sometimes you speed up and sometimes you slow down. How did you recognize your signal lights, and then what would you do to release?
Sure. My signal lights were all about what was going through my mind. If I'm in green light, there's nothing going through my mind, but I was an up-tempo pitcher. I like to change and make hitters uncomfortable by how fast I worked. So my green lights were really, really bright green. I mean, I was on the rubber, making them uncomfortable by how fast. I wanted to get on and off that mound as soon as possible. And that came down to less warm-up pitches for me because I wanted to get that game rolling, get that inning going, make that on-deck guy have one swing with a donut on his bat, and he's already being told to get in the batter's box. So I like to up-tempo guys in my green lights. When I got to yellow lights, it was little things, maybe a call that didn't go my way or maybe a pitch that I didn't feel like I executed. I would not get off the dirt. My yellow light was still, I acknowledged that I made maybe a mistake mentally or physically and tried to release that by taking a good, solid, deep breath, but still not leaving that dirt because I still wanted to up-tempo them. But then on a red light, for me, I needed to get off that mound. I needed to get off that dirt. I needed to turn my back to the plate, pick up my focal point, which was the top of the flagpole, because I knew there was going to be a flagpole at every single stadium I played at. So I'd get that focal point. As soon as I'd get that focal point, I'd take a huge deep breath, turn back. By the time I would turn back around, it was all about that's gone, that's flushed, I'm not carrying that. My only goal is to get back into green lights to release, refocus, and dominate the next pitch and get to that next pitch. Don't carry all the baggage from the pitches before or the pitch before.
Love it. Love that. You know, now if we kind of transition into Kirk Sarlos, the pitching coach, you get your five-year Major League Baseball career. Did you go right into coaching, or did you have any time off? What happened there?
Yeah, so 2009 in July is when I basically shut it down from playing, and I was living up in Seattle, Washington, and where my wife's from. We live there in the off seasons, and I was a member at a country club up there, and I love to play golf. It's very similar to pitching. Playing golf is very similar, and I like the challenge, the mental challenge, the you versus the golf course kind of challenge. And so I wanted to play golf for one straight year, see how many rounds I could play and enjoy that and do nothing but play golf. And that's what I did. I enjoyed it, but at the same time, for me, mentally, I was searching for something. I needed to get back into to baseball. I was missing it. You know, from the playing side of things, I was at the end. Physically couldn't do it anymore, so I shut it down. But then that 1 year off, I was itching to get back into the collegiate game because that was, in my opinion, the four best years of my life that kind of shaped who I am, you know, as a man now. So I wanted to get back into it and be around young people and try and teach them the things that I went through. So maybe I could help them get to a level where I was lucky enough to get through. And I had some great coaches, Coach Serrano, Coach Horton, Coach Vanderhook, you know, guys like that that are, you know, in this profession are, you know, widely respected. So I wanted to get back into that. And so I went to Cal State Fullerton. I still had a couple courses I needed to finish up for my degree. So I was the 30-year-old creepy dude in the back corner of class finishing my degree at 30 years old. People wondering what the heck's my story and why I'm 30 in the back of a class. So
love it.
Was a undergrad assistant under Coach Serrano. He let me handle a lot of the pitching, handle a lot of the pitchers because he was the head coach and couldn't do quite as much. And so I got my feet wet with that. And then Coach left and Coach Vanderhook took over and he hired me as the pitching coach at Fullerton. And it was awesome. You know, it was, you know, I owe a lot to Coach Vanderhook to get me into the collegiate kind of coaching community. And from that point forward, it was basically, how are we going to get the most out of our players, both physically and mentally? You know, teaching them new pitches, teach them how to pitch, how to control the running game is one thing. The other thing is how we're going to reach their potential and break through that roof. And for me, it's the mental game. That's the thing that I wanted to kind of mesh was the physicality of the recruit that we have and then the mental side of it and try and get them to put them together and trying to make them the best possible player. So when they do leave school, they don't spend a ton of time in minor league baseball. They need to get to the big leagues as soon as they can. And I think the way to do that is through the mental game.
Well, you go from Cal State Fullerton to TCU, when did you get to TCU? When did you arrive in Fort Worth?
I think it was, this will be coming up on my fourth season, so whatever that makes it, 2012, 2012-13, I believe, was the first year here at TCU.
And I know one of the players that you had a tremendous impact on from a mental game standpoint is, you know, it ties right in with what you said about having guys get to the big leagues as quick as possible, was Brandon Finnegan, the only guy in the history of Major League Baseball to pitch both in Omaha in the College World Series and in the Major League Baseball World Series in the same year in 2014 with the Kansas City Royals. You know, could you talk a little bit just about, you know, whether it's Finney or Preston Morrison or Alex Young or some of the guys that you've had a chance to work with that are elite and the guys that you know, are the All-Americans, Riley Farrells. And maybe what are some of the things that you see the guys that perform the best that they do from a mental game standpoint, but that maybe some of the other guys don't do? Are there any commonalities that you see now as a coach in those pitchers that succeed at the highest level and those guys that maybe fall a little bit short of where we think they could be?
Yeah, sure. It's interesting. It's the guys that are the best at the mental game that I've been around, especially here at TCU, are also the guys that pitch the most and are the best when it comes down to performing and being on the mound. So the guys that probably you would say physically don't need the mental game maybe as much, they could just lie on straight physicality, they actually are the best when it comes to the mental game. So, you know, it's what came first, the chicken or the egg. So for me, it's, like I said, it's blending those two together. The guys that understand that their physical presence on the mound is only going to get them so far, Preston Morrison comes to mind. You know, Brandon Finnegan, the guys that you talked about. You know, Brandon Finnegan was a guy that, elite left-handed pitcher. The first day I met with Brandon, I said, I want to make you the best, not just left-hander, but the best pitcher in all of college baseball by the time you leave here. That next year he went 0-8. So he's probably looking at me wondering what's going on. He pitched well. He just, you know, just wasn't able to get any wins, and then pitched for Team USA and then came back and had an unbelievable junior year, got drafted in the middle of the first round, and like you said, big league World Series, college World Series. But the main thing for Brandon was the switch from I'm going to blow you away with my stuff to I'm going to become a pitcher. I'm going to trust and understand that I can fill up the strike zone and not hunt for strikeouts. I can use my mental game to get me through starts that I might not have my best stuff. And I think that's where Brandon really, really transitioned to become an elite, is when he knew that on the days that he wasn't very good, he can get people out by his mental strength and his mental preparation. So, and I think it translated, you saw his routine, his breath, his exact routine on the mound was the exact same when he was at TCU, and then when he was in October in the World Series, it was the exact same thing. So he bought into it, understood it, and still to this day uses all that stuff. So Preston Morrison, another guy that was like me, wasn't very physically gifted, but got people out with his mind and his attention to detail. And the guys that use it the most end up being the guys that, for us at TCU, are the best day in and day out on the mound.
You know, and Preston Morrison, a three-time All-American, you know, at TCU, and I think he was Pitcher of the Year in the Big 12, in the Mountain West, you know, in both conferences. I mean, just an unbelievable performing athlete. And one of the things that Preston, you know, what taught me a lot about the mental game was just the value of meditation and the value of breathing practice. And I know, you know, last year we were together out playing at Dodger Stadium in a tournament with TCU and playing Vanderbilt. And Alan Jaeger, who's a friend of both of ours, came out and took the guys through a couple different meditation exercises, a little bit different style than some of the things that I've done. And I thought it was fantastic to expose the guys to that. What are some things that you do as a pitching coach that maybe are part of your daily routine or weekly routine that you would say are mental game drills and ways that we train ourselves mentally?
We spend 10 minutes every single day. That's part of our practice plan right after our stretch as a team. The great thing is Coach Schlossnagel, Coach Mosiello, Coach Etheridge, they carve out in our practice plan the ability for me and the pitchers to get 30, 40 minutes at the beginning of practice where we're not rushed to get our throwing in, to get our mental game in, to get our additional stretch in. That's our time at the very beginning of practice. We get 40 minutes where we basically can get better from, a lot of times, not even picking up a baseball in those first 30 or 40 minutes of practice. Right after stretch, we'll go into our hitting facility, and I'll plug in my iPhone, and we'll go through some, whether it be, each day is a little bit different. We might do some breathing exercises where the guys are laying down and we're going through some breathing exercises. The next day we might go through just a little meditation of listening to you and your pitcher mental imagery training tracks that we have on my iPhone. So they're laying down. If you people would walk by and wonder what's going on, we're all laying down. The lights are off and the guys are laying on their back and people are wondering, are they practicing or sleeping? Well, this is a huge part of our practice plan is to get them tuned in right at the beginning of practice. And so we do it every single day, anywhere from 5 minutes up to 15 to 20 minutes. Some days I'll jump in there after listening to your podcast and then I'll take over and we'll go through some mental innings where I put them in situations and they have to go through what they are seeing visually with their eyes closed, and just because you can only get on the mound so much as a pitcher. So my philosophy here is how are we going to get better as a pitching staff when we can get on a mound maybe two times, maybe three times in a week? Are we only going to get better as a pitcher by being on a mound three times a week? Well, for me, that's a no. We're going to get better 6 days a week or 5 days a week, whatever we have practice plan-wise, but whether it be mental bullpens, whether it be shadow work, we spend a ton of time without throwing a baseball getting better, and it all has to do with how your mind is going to be able to take over what you're physically doing. You know, your mind, your body doesn't understand the difference between you physically doing it or if you are doing it mentally and doing mental reps. So we do a ton of mental reps without putting one, you know, stress on the arm by throwing a baseball.
And one of the things I know that people have asked me about a lot, Kirk, is with all the exposure that TCU baseball had got in the last few years, going making two runs of the College World Series in 2014 and 2015, was that during the game, during that first inning, the first five innings or so, there's always two pitchers in the bullpen that look like they're getting ready to warm up and go in the game before the first pitch is thrown. What's going on there?
Yeah, even our home TV and radio guy, I've told him multiple times, but he gets stewed every single time when we got two guys rolling in the first inning and our Friday night guy's throwing in the first, and he threw his first pitch, and there's two guys what looks like are throwing their first pitch, warming up in the bullpen, and he kind of questions me on the air sometimes, wondering why we got guys warming up already. Well, they're not throwing a baseball. They're shadowing. All of our relievers will have two innings, back-to-back innings, first and second. The next two guys will be third and fourth and so on all the way through the eighth inning where our closer gets up. But what they're doing is basically they're shadowing what's going on live on the field. Without throwing a baseball, they might do a towel. They'll have a towel to do a towel drill or without a towel. But if the guy throws a pitch and a guy hits a roll over to the first baseman and we got to cover that, we take a couple steps. We throw the pitch, take a couple steps to reenact what's going on the field. We'll do that in the bullpen. So by the end of the year, we might have a guy that has only thrown 8, 9, 10 innings, but we're in a super regional game. Or for instance, 2 years ago, we were locked in a 22 inning game and we had to turn the ball over to a guy, two guys that probably combined had 20 innings on the year. And they both combined through about 7 shutout to get us over the hump in that 22 inning game. And talking with them, they felt like they had already thrown 60 innings or had 60 appearances by that time of the year because every single game they were down there doing that shadow work. So really, though, it comes down to your players and getting it across to them because it's only as much as you put into it. You can tell them to go down there, but if they don't buy into it or don't understand the importance of it, it's a waste of time. And so, you know, and that's why we do it daily because it's important and they see the results. And next thing you know, when spring rolls around, you know, they tweak and they change things in the fall. So when the spring rolls around, they know exactly their routine and their mental game and how it's going to help them.
And you feel like you know, freshmen, I always hear this from college coaches saying, well, you know, our freshmen have never failed. That's why they're playing Division I college baseball in the Big 12 or in the SEC or ACC or the PAC. And they've never failed, so they're not gonna be into the mental game. They think it's weird, you know, that they're throwing a bullpen with no ball. How have you used that as an advantage in terms? How have you used the mental game as an advantage, whether it's in recruiting or when players get on campus? How long does it take for them to completely sell out and buy into what you're trying to get them to do?
Well, I think it starts from your upperclassmen, your guys that have been in the program. You know, I've been lucky enough to have phenomenal guys on our pitching staff here at TCU from day one, 4 years ago, that, you know, they've had you for
10 or 11 years,
yeah. You know, the program has. And so to varying different degrees, guys have, you know, have bought in to very, you know, very different degrees. And since I kind of showed up, I was lucky enough to have guys that were 100% bought in from the first second. And, you know, it's a tribute to you, and it's a tribute to basically being there on a daily basis and having, you know, I think the big thing is you hire someone to do the mental game and he leaves. Well, it becomes about your program, your coaches, and the people that are going to then run with that.
Yeah.
Because it's pointless if you hire somebody, he comes in, it's great, he leaves, and you don't put any attention or focus on it when he's gone. You know, so I think it comes down to the ownership of, you know, the coach, the position coach, to really make sure that it's a priority. And for me, it's kind of preaching what I lived, you know. So for me, it was a priority because that's who I was, and that's, you know, what I needed to get to the next level. So, you know, it's about staying on top of them, keeping them accountable. And then ultimately it comes down to proof is in the pudding, you know. And in the 4 years, it's the guys that continue to come back, they explain to the guys and are around our guys how important that is. And so it just keeps trickling down year in, year out. It just keeps trickling down, and it trickles out down from the top.
Awesome. Kirk, we're going to give you one more question here. We're going to kind of change topics and look at, you know, as a guy who's got young children and is married and, you know, spent a lot of years on the road playing Major League Baseball, and now as a coach and recruiter on the road still a lot, how do you manage the balance between your career and also being an all-star dad? How do you do that?
That's, you know, that's the big thing with, I think, college baseball, you know, because as a coach in general, you got to pour your heart, soul, time, effort, everything into this profession, because like you said, the recruiting has sped up. So you're on the road pretty much all summer, you know, and then you're spending probably a lot of time, more time with your players than you are with your family. So for me, it's a very, very fine line where as soon as it's, you know, the coaching hat comes off, the recruiting hat never comes off, but when the coaching hat comes off and you're at home, it's about investing quality time, you know, trying to get that phone put away in the other room so, you know, you're not with your children and they see you on your phone and they understand that what's on that phone that's more important than spending time with me, Dad. So with Brady, my oldest, and then my two girls under him, you know, trying to have intentional quality time with them and my wife, uninterrupted. You know, that's the main thing. You don't get a ton of time, but when you do, you have to make it uninterrupted and make sure there's nothing that's going to get in the way of you and them, for the most part, understanding that they're the most important thing, you know, and not that phone. I think we get too tied to our phones and technology and social media nowadays that, you know, we have to unplug a little bit more as a society, and that's what I try to do when I'm with my family and my wife.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you taking time for this. Can I put you on the hot seat, which is a kind of a speed round where I say a one word or a question,
you got
and
it.
Just come with it. You ready?
How many words do I get?
You get as many words as you want. Just quick answers, you know, try to keep them like 15, 30 seconds. First thing that comes to your mind. Are you sure you're ready for this?
I'm ready to dominate the day, Brian.
All right, here we go. Omaha.
Back to back.
Pepe's.
Legit breakfast burrito.
Titans.
History.
Can revisit.
Good history, not as in past history,
yeah,
but
yeah.
The history of the program.
Yeah, no doubt. Ken Revisa.
Legend.
We got Zach Etheridge, who just came in behind you.
Hot round.
We're going the hot round. He's on the hot seat. Very nice. Missile command.
You're way better than I.
No hitter.
I don't tell my guys that I was part of a six-pitcher no hitter. I just said I threw a no hitter in Yankee Stadium. I just leave the details out.
Baseball.
Greatest sport ever.
And you are off the hot seat. Thank you, Kirk. Appreciate you making time here, my friend. For coaches that want to be able to follow up with you and you know, maybe have you come to speak at one of their coaches' clinics or just follow up for more information as someone who's committed to growing the game, what's the best way for those guys to get a hold of you? Is there a Twitter account or an email address or anything?
Yeah, probably an email address. It's K.Sarlos, last name S-A-A-R-L-O-O-S. At tcu.edu. And then on Twitter, it's at Kirk_Sarlos. Either one is It was good.
Awesome. Kirk, appreciate you making time to be on the podcast here. Man, I'm going to turn off the recorder. You're the man. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Brian Kane Peak Performance Podcast. Please make sure that you visit briankane.com. That's briankane.com. And sign up for my Monday message, where every Monday I deliver straight to your inbox videos, interviews, articles, tips, techniques, and strategies that you can use to master the mental game. You can also contact me through my website on our Contact Us page and see my calendar of where I'm going to be in the country and when I'm coming to your area so that we can get together and that we can continue to go out there and dominate the day.
This is a production of Corn Belt Sports. The Brian Kane Peak Performance Podcast is part of the Top Coach Network.